Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Last week, President Trump announced a plan to cut legal immigration to the United States by half. Any change in the law would have to be approved by Congress. But among other provisions, the president's plan would make it more difficult for immigrants living legally in the United States to bring over family members. My colleague Bill Dorman spoke with Honolulu immigration attorney John Egan, who says that provision would be especially relevant for Hawaii.
Here in Hawaii, the vast majority of immigration is family-based immigration, so it's going to have an immediate impact on Hawaii families. And as you know, almost every family in Hawaii has some members who are recently arrived. So this is going to be huge, and it's going to be immediate. They're talking about stretching it out over 10 years, but we're going to start seeing effects immediately this goes through.
And this is one of those areas when you look at Hawaii compared to the nation at large, Hawaii is much more an area of immigrants than many other parts of the country.
Well, yes. A lot of people don't realize that Hawaii ranks up in the top five states for immigrants in our population in terms of percentage of our population. It's about 18%, a little bit less. So we're right up with New York, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Florida. We're right up there in the top in terms of having a lot of incoming immigrants in our population. So this is really going to be a big deal.
And the history of Hawaii, certainly, as with the history of America, is a history of immigration. But in Hawaii, the idea of various periods and various folks, right now, Filipino immigration would be hit particularly, then the Filipino community would be hit particularly hard by this. Yeah?
Well, yes, because of the historical aspect of that. You know, the Filipino community is largely built on the late plantation era, where plantation workers were coming from many different places, but predominantly the Philippines in the later part of the plantation era. And because those people had the expectation that if they came here and worked hard, they would be allowed to bring their families, that's what's been happening. So we're seeing that sort of knock-on effect of that bubble of Filipino immigration still today.
The United States, still clearly a nation of laws. Laws need to go through Congress. This cannot be done by presidential edict. But whether or not this survives going through Congress, there's a tone that is set by an administration. As an immigration attorney yourself, how do you feel that shift in tone? What does that mean?
Well, I feel it sort of as a reflection from my clientele. What I feel, I mean, I'm a seventh generation American with, I'm strictly middle of the sort of body politic. So he says these things, and it doesn't threaten me, but it threatens everybody I know. Come on, you know, we're looking at a place like Hawaii where there are a lot of people who have either just recently arrived or have expectations that their family members will arrive in the coming few years. So I'm getting calls from all over the place, getting people saying, I think I better do something about this now, or calling and saying, what is going on? What am I supposed to do here? I have someone coming in. You know, some of the people from the Philippines, for example, are waiting 14 and 15 years to get family members in. Well, what about the people who have been waiting in line, done everything they were supposed to do, doing it all correctly for 13 and a half years, and this is the news they hear? That they're not going to get their brother in or their sister. That's pretty upsetting news for a lot of people. And so that's how I hear it, is people calling me and asking, what am I supposed to do now?
And what do you tell them when they call?
And I say, well, wait and see. We really don't know. Honestly, I don't believe that this piece of legislation is going to pass. But that's an opinion. We'll have to wait to see what does happen. There's not really a clear and obvious way to predict what this administration is actually going to be able to accomplish.
How has life for you as an immigration attorney in Hawaii changed, say, since January 20th or last November?
Well, it's gotten kind of hectic, honestly. We, as a group, are kind of on the front lines of that anxiety that people are feeling about immigration status. you know, this whole idea that we should be changing the number of immigrants that we allow in the country, that's not threatening. You know, nobody that I know of feels that that's a topic that we can't touch. Of course, we are a nation of immigrants, so we get to choose. Mm-hmm. How many immigrants do we want to have come in? What type of immigrants? How are we going to prioritize them? I don't think anybody feels that that's a topic that we shouldn't be talking about. But to come in with no kind of notice and say we're about to slash it by 50%, well, that gives people a lot of concern. So as an immigration attorney, we try to figure out what do we do for people in this kind of a situation. It's challenging.
I imagine it would be. For Hawaii specifically, in terms of different areas of the economy, I'm thinking right now, clients in the hospitality industry for you.
Well, absolutely. You know, we look at our beautiful, exotic, tropical destination, and what we see is the beach, and we see the palm trees and the beautiful lobbies. But who's cleaning up those hotels? Who's making that garden so beautiful? When you go out and look and see who's really doing the work to make the hospitality industry function, you're going to find that it's low-skilled immigrants. That's who's doing it. You know, I work in an office building. Pretty much that's where lawyers, you'll find us. Every day at 5 o'clock, everybody else leaves. I tend to stay a little bit longer. But from 5 to 9 p.m., that building is filled with immigrants cleaning up. So who's going to do that if we decide we're all going to throw them all out? And those people got here mostly on family-based visas. Where do they find work when they get here? You know, wherever they can. And that's where we're finding, you know, all across, all sectors, hospitality, building maintenance.
Agriculture frequently gets mentioned.
Well, that's a really interesting topic to me, I think. Clearly, you know, when you look at the national scale of immigration issues, California stands out, the Pacific Northwest, a number of other places, the dairy industry. They all know that those industries absolutely depend on the undocumented labor coming from Latin America. People don't think about this in the Hawaii context particularly, but we're talking about diversified agriculture being the future of agriculture in Hawaii. Think about that for just a moment. Every one of those diversified crops is a hand-picked crop. Everything from macadamia nuts to coffee to salad greens, you name it, it's hand-picked. Who's going to pick that stuff? That's not what we're teaching kids in ag school. We're teaching people in the, you know, College of Tropical Agriculture at UH. Farm management, yes. Picking lettuce? No, we don't want our kids doing that. You don't raise your kids, send them to college to pick lettuce. We got to get a labor force. If we're going to have diversified agriculture in Hawaii, we need to have a labor force. Historically, it's always come from immigration.
John Egan is an immigration attorney in Honolulu, former chair of the Hawaii chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. John, thanks for coming down today.
My pleasure.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, some great films that aren't summer blockbusters. But first, your quiz.
We just heard how some proposed changes to the U.S. immigration system could affect communities here in Hawaii. The Hawaiian Islands are a true melting pot with a long history of accepting immigrants dating back to the days of the monarchy. From Kamehameha and John Young all the way to the present day, Hawaii has a tradition of attracting advisors and laborers to the island from abroad. At no time was this more prevalent than in the plantation era, when workers by the thousands came from Europe, Asia, the Americas, and other Pacific Island nations. In 1903, a group of 103 Koreans landed in the territory of Hawaii, becoming the first Korean immigrants to the United States. Among their number were 56 men recruited to work the sugarcane fields, 21 women, and 25 children. They arrived aboard a British-flagged ship, and today we're looking for its name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote that tells people you got it right.
Support for today's programming comes from the BIA New Summer Home Building and Remodeling Show, featuring new exhibitors and new seminars, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Blaisdell, biahawaii.org.
The Honolulu Gay and Lesbian Cultural Foundation is presenting the 28th Annual Honolulu Rainbow Film Festival. It's one of the longest-running LGBT film festivals in this country. This time around, there'll be 20 screenings with films from across the globe, and if the ones I previewed are any indication, we're in for a huge treat here. Richard Kawada studied American media. He's the director of programming for the Rainbow Film Festival. Welcome, Richard.
Well, thank you for having me.
So great to have you here. You know, just overview of the selections. This is a festival on a mission. It really seems like it. I mean, just take one example, Forbidden, Undocumented, and Queer in Rural America. What a slice of life that must be, Richard.
Oh, yes. Well, this year, the board really felt that activism should be a major theme.
You mean activism in film? Because this is the film festival itself, really jumping in, you know, with both feet and being activist itself. Mm-hmm. Yeah, after so many years, to 28 years, this is the first year that you're really kind of putting it forward.
Well, I think in light of the political climate, activism as a theme for our festival is warranted. People who are at risk and the most vulnerable in our population are being targeted.
You know, what's interesting, too, is the lack of sort of, I guess, polemics in the films. I mean, in a way, the ones that I looked at really dealt with the human side of things. And it made me wonder what it is that really makes people change. I mean, we can see the surface level of people demonstrating and so on, but on what level do we really internally make a change? I'm thinking about that, the movie from Tonga.
Oh, yes. Leda Eva.
Right. I mean, it's a film about a Tongan lady, right? Would you say a gay person?
Yes. Or a transgender
person. Transgender. Okay. It was, I mean, this person is kind of portly, you know, visually. And her voice, though, really got me. She explains without rancor or hatred or any psychological in and out, just her situation.
My brother told me, how many years now you joining together with the Tonga Ladies Association? You should change now. And that's very hard for me. He don't have any right to judge others. But because of the feeling like I'm a lady, I have to stand and tell the people who am I.
Tina Turner, are you ready?
She's talking about, here she is coming on stage. She does a cartwheel and everything else on stage here. It's incredible, Richard. You know, somehow getting into her life makes the difference. We could say it, but seeing it in film makes the difference.
Yes, I think film is perhaps the most important art form of the 20th century. It plants a seed of awareness in people, and people respond to film in a very visceral and emotional level. So yes, I think it is an effective tool in transforming consciousness and awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And so with the case of Lady Eva, seeing depictions of sexuality and gender being so fluid, it gets people to think about the solidity of identity.
Oh, you're so right about that. I mean, that's the way that, I guess, seeing tender homosexual relationships makes heterosexuals kind of deconstruct their whole way of thinking.
Oh, absolutely.
And
it also frees them up to perhaps forge and expand upon new relationship forms.
Speaking of which, I mean, geez, Richard, look, you've studied film. Did the Star Wars bar scene affect any of this people's ability to feel like, how different can this other human being be compared to an extraterrestrial sitting next to me enjoying my company?
We're not all that different.
Yeah, right. I mean, so all of this, right,
yes,
helps us break down walls?
Oh, absolutely. And it makes people more comfortable. And at the end, we realize we're all really the same.
Mm-hmm. What other films can you pick out from your showings to highlight for us? I love 19.
Oh, yes, 19. Now, that brings up a point about our current hookup culture. It's about a 19-year-old boy who is terminally ill, and he has arranged a sexual liaison with an escort. Absolutely, his first and last, yes.
Oh, I mean, that could have been handled in a sensational way, but it is handled in a way that was just so touching.
It was handled in a very touching way.
Mm-hmm.
And what really struck me on an emotional level was how the escort wanted to treat it as business, strictly business, and did not want to get to know his client at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the moment he found out that he was terminally ill,
a little wall went down.
Absolutely. He wanted to get to know him.
You know, this is a way that these gay-themed films are highlighting aspects of heterosexual culture, this sort of hookup scene.
Oh, yes. In our current hookup scenes, apps are a very big part of this hookup culture.
Mm-hmm.
And Tinder, and for the gay culture, Grindr. And unfortunately, it's undermining monogamous relationships and intimacy.
Hmm. Is that a problem? Is it turning out to be a problem in the films you've surveyed?
Or? Well, five of the films, short films that we have in our lineup, deal specifically with Grindr or in our hookup culture, and it doesn't really paint a very, let's say it just paints a very cynical picture of the whole culture.
Hmm, interesting. What, from the films you've seen this year, what's the future of intimacy? How are we going to get this holy grail in our culture?
Well, let's not make polyamory a new norm superior to monogamy and intimacy.
Yeah.
And I think that's the message behind a lot of these short films in our lineup.
Really? I mean, you've even introduced a word, polyamory. It was the topic of a Time magazine cover story recently. I mean, this is stuff that's in the broader culture that we've seen the seeds of here in the Rainbow Film Festival in past years, and you've really brought them forward this time around. You've got fun stuff too. You've got that zombie flick, of course.
Absolutely. Horror. A lot of horror short films.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of comedy. So we entertain and educate.
Oh, man. Thank you so much. And thank you for the research that pulling these films together require. I mean, I just think tenderness on screen in these films has helped us to make sense of some of these situations. And I think it could work in real life, too.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks so much for being here, Richard. You could say touching us deeply is one way to seed change. And Looking forward to it at the Rainbow Film Festival, 28th runaround this time. Richard Kawada's on the Film Selection Committee. He heads the Programming Committee, and it's been great to have him here today. The Film Festival opens this Thursday, 10 days of films and events. Find out more at the Duristic Theater site, or we've got links on the Conversation Facebook page.
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting guitarist Otmar Liebert and his band Luna Negra, performing Spanish flamenco-inspired music, 7:30 p.m. this Thursday at Castle Theater, MauiArts.org.
Drive on any back road on Oahu and you're likely to find one or more abandoned cars. Junk cars are easily ditched and are a lot tougher to get rid of legally than they used to be. The result is an island-wide problem that's getting out of control. Civil Beat intern Natanya Friedheim has a reality check. Hi, Natanya.
Hi.
So this story is, has got more than its share of visuals, because I'm sure in the course of reporting it, you saw quite a few abandoned cars, didn't you?
Yeah, we saw quite a few, and it's a pretty striking sight. You know, these cars are sort of decaying and rusting and have been sort of ripped apart and, taken for whatever their valuable parts are. So engines or tires have been removed.
And you can tell they've been there a long time because there's plants growing up through the body, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, it used to be that when your car was getting ready to breathe its last, you could drive to a junkyard and say, hey, you know, what do you give me for this? Why has that changed?
Well, a couple of reasons. The main reason is that the price of scrap metal on the global market is going down significantly, and it has gone down since the Great Recession. I used to be able to sell an old car at Island Recycling, which is one of two companies on Oahu that shreds old cars and then sells that shredded metal, sort of exports it to the mainland or Pacific Rim countries that have smelters. Since the recession, you know, the price of an old car has gone down from about $100 to just $20. And when you factor in the... Oh, right. Sorry.
Not worth the toll, right?
Exactly.
Well, so the whole economic factor is that there's no longer any real incentive to run a junkyard, or at least it's rapidly declining, I would think.
Mm-hmm. And it's getting more expensive. I mean, if you can make money off of an old engine that's still usable, that's worth it. But at the same time, you have towing expenses, you have overhead. And I've spoken with some employees at salvage yards in Kalihi and other parts of the island who say that rents in industrial areas are going up so high that they're not really able to, not able to stay in business. It's becoming more and more difficult.
Well, given that it's no longer profitable for any private entity to get rid of your car, whose job is it to take care of these abandoned cars?
Great question. It's the city's responsibility to address abandoned vehicles on the side of roads, and that's the Department of Customer Service. And the city does offer a program where they will sort of junk a car for free. The issue then is if folks don't have the title to their vehicle and have to register their car, if they have any back taxes or old tickets, it becomes expensive to pay for the registration for a car that you're just going to junk.
So there's the path of least resistance for a great many people would be take it out to a cane field, ditch it, take off the plates and beat feet away from there, right?
Exactly. And there are also an increasing number of cars left by military personnel who might have to leave on short notice and can only take one car with them, according to the Joint Travel Regulation. You know, families are only allowed to ship one vehicle, so it becomes an issue with military personnel as well.
It would seem that we have a scenario where this problem is only likely to increase, would you say, Natanya?
Indeed. You know, the elected officials that I spoke with were definitely searching for solutions still and having a difficult time finding them because we do live on an island where space is limited.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye on this story. Thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org, and today we featured intern Natanya Friedheim. Medical marijuana has been the law in Hawaii for years, so where is it? Lawmakers have been reminded, as the logjam over delivery continues, that there's often a gap between passage of a law and its implementation. Brian Goldstein is founder and CEO of one of the 8 licensed medical cannabis dispensaries in the state. He expects to be up and running soon, and he's with us in our studio. Brian, let's just review the last few years. What has happened in the last few years to move us closer?
Well, Hawaii passed a medical marijuana patient registry in 2000, but there was no dispensaries that patients could go to mm-hmm. purchase their medicine. So in 2015, the legislature passed a dispensary bill, and in 2016, the licenses were awarded. And here we are in 2017, and it looks like I know we'll be opening our first dispensary here probably in the next couple of months.
In the course of preparing to do this, there's been a lot of, you have to educate a workforce to work in your dispensaries. You also have to educate the community.
Yeah, we've been engaging for quite some time now. And even before we received a license, we've been engaging in community education and outreach and talk story sessions. And in fact, just a couple of weeks ago, we held 19 events that had over 400 people and over 60 physicians and registered nurses that we engaged with in our education and talk story and outreach sessions.
In these sessions, you learn about the things that people do understand, but you also learn about the things that people don't understand, right?
Yeah, a big part of our outreach is really demystifying and destigmatizing this this plant, this medicine, which has been used by human beings for over 3,000 years. It was only in the last 100 years that prohibition really created the stigmatization that this plant experiences today. And when people learn the political and racist undertones that led to prohibition, I think they're shocked and their minds are opened up to understanding how cannabis is a medicine. The one thing I would point out also is there is a incredibly important report published by the U.S. government earlier this year by the National Academy of Sciences, which is the premier scientific research organization by the U.S. government. And in this report, it stated that there is conclusive evidence, which is the highest standard that the National mm-hmm. Academy of Sciences has, that there is conclusive evidence that cannabis is medicine and effective in the treatment of chronic pain, spasticity, as well as nausea. So the debate as to whether cannabis is medicine is over. Now it's just a question of getting people to understand that.
You referred to the political and racist overtones of prohibition. What are those? What is that history?
Well, actually, cannabis was a widely used medicine in the late 1800s and early 1930s. And as alcohol prohibition was ramping down, the head of the then Drug Enforcement Administration, Harry Anslinger, needed a new bogeyman. He needed something else to prohibit. So he teamed up with the Hearst newspaper chain, and they rebranded cannabis to marijuana. Marijuana was not a term of art used back then except by Mexican immigrants. Mm-hmm. And so they created a national campaign. You may have heard of the movie Reefer Madness. Mm-hmm. That was the highlight of that campaign, where they They, in national media publications, describe the use of cannabis as making people crazy and making white women wanting to get together with black and colored people. So there's a massive racist overtones to the prohibition.
What was their motivation? What was in it for them creating this stigma?
You know, I don't know, really understand why back then. I think they needed something to prohibit. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it wasn't until 1972 that cannabis was illegal at the federal level, when in 1972 the Nixon administration added cannabis, marijuana, to the Controlled Substances Act. And it was part of his anti-war effort to label hippies, who were the anti-war protesters, to give the police a reason to arrest them. Mm-hmm. So there was the history behind prohibition of cannabis is really fascinating, in the political and racist overtones.
Well, just to go back to the history, you refer to the 19th century. It should be pointed out that you could also, in the 19th century, get cocaine, morphine, opium, and heroin. Heroin being a brand name of Bayer Pharmaceutical, right?
Exactly. And in fact, cocaine and opiates are Schedule II drugs, and marijuana, which does have known medical properties and a low propensity for abuse, is on Schedule I with LSD. Mm-hmm. And heroin, which are both highly addictive.
So now that the confusion is being essentially sorted out, the public is, as you're describing in these workshops you're doing, the public has some catching up to do with the history and the actual medical nature of this substance, yeah?
Yeah, you know, I'm really really gratified when I finish one of these talks. And nearly every time, one or more people come up to me and talk to me about a parent or loved one that might have arthritis or multiple sclerosis or Parkinson's disease, and they have questions as to whether cannabis can be helpful in the symptoms exhibited by those diseases. And in fact, usually it is. And, you know, although a lot of research needs to be done, don't get me wrong, it's not a panacea. But there is I see the community here in Hawaii opening up more and more to understanding the potential for this plant as medicine.
The federal government has been pretty openly, particularly the Justice Department, has been in open opposition to legalized marijuana. Where's that going to go?
Well, marijuana is a Schedule I controlled substance, so the possession and sale is against federal law. But Congress, for the last several years, has passed an amendment called the Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment, which prohibits the Justice Department from spending any resources enforcing federal anti-marijuana laws in medical marijuana states such as Hawaii. So in states that have medical programs like Hawaii, Arizona, Nevada, Illinois, Maryland, New York, and numerous others, the federal government, the Justice Department, Jeff Sessions, as it were, is prohibited from enforcing federal marijuana laws. So in Hawaii, there is very little risk of any kind of federal enforcement actions, although you might see something take place in recreational states such as Colorado, Oregon, and Washington.
Is there a consensus from the medical marijuana states that it's a success?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the Journal of American Medicine has shown that in medical marijuana states, the rates of opioid usage and deaths have been decreasing every year.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye on this. You think you're a couple months away?
Yeah, we expect to be opening our dispensary in a couple months. We'll be announcing the opening date probably in the next 4 weeks or so.
Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Goldstein is founder and CEO of Manoa Botanicals, LLC, one of 8 licensed medical cannabis dispensaries in the state of Hawaii. Manoa Botanicals will be opening its first flagship dispensary this fall.
Aloha.
We're the Hawaiian Style Band.
You're listening to The Conversation
on member-supported
Hawaii Public Radio.
It's time for Stargazer, our weekly look at what's happening in our dark island skies and the massive universe around our ridiculously small planet. And as usual, we're turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be back. So this week, Stargazers, Jupiter and Saturn can be seen in the southwestern sky throughout the night. Jupiter will be setting around 10 p.m., followed by Saturn at 2 a.m. Our moon will be quite bright this week as it begins to pass through its full moon phase, so wait until later on before trying to spot those faint meteors and satellites.
You've got something this week on a space telescope that we have not heard from in a little while, Hubble, and something about studying atmosphere.
Yep, the Hubble Space Telescope is continuing to deliver wondrous science as it passes through its 28th year in space.
Wow.
A team from the University of Exeter in the United Kingdom has used Hubble to detect water molecules in the stratosphere of a planet 880 light years away. This planet is called WASP-121b, after the WASP telescope that was used to discover it.
That seems like such an incredible find for a piece of kit, as you like to say in your country, that is almost three decades old. Tell us a little bit more about the discovery.
Well, Hubble is equipped with spectroscopic instruments that can determine the chemical makeup of an object just by looking at its light. Despite the spectrometer on Hubble being quite old, it is still a fantastic piece of kit. And it has an advantage, of course, of being above the Earth's atmosphere.
I guess that's what makes Hubble so useful, is that it's in space, so despite it being pretty old, it's got an advantage. It's right out there where it needs to be observing, sort of.
Yep, high above the Earth's atmosphere.
And what can you tell us about the planet, Christopher?
Well, the planet itself is what we call a hot Jupiter. This basically means it's similar to our own Jupiter in mass and size, but a lot closer to its sun. The temperature on this planet is around 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit. Very toasty indeed.
And the fact that this thing has a stratosphere must mean it's able to hang onto its atmosphere despite being so close to the sun.
Totally. This is really good news for our understanding of how planets interact with their stars. The more we study these types of worlds, the better our understanding will be of how atmospheres work, including our own.
It's Christopher Phillips and another Stargazer report. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, designer of the Noah Daniel K. Inouye Regional Center, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
In today's backyard quiz, we asked you to give us the name of the ship that carried the first group of Korean immigrants to Hawaii and, by extension, the United States. The ship was operated by the Occidental and Oriental Steamship Company and brought its history-making passengers to Honolulu in January 1903. 102 men, women, and children disembarked, becoming the first Korean immigrants in Hawaii or the U.S., but they'd be followed by more than 7,000 of their countrymen over the next 5 years, the vast majority of whom were men. Emigrating to the United States was seen as attractive by many Koreans who were seeking to modernize their homeland. Many Korean immigrants to Hawaii would continue onto the mainland and settle in California. But it all started with that first group aboard the RMS Gaelic. That was the answer we were looking for to today's quiz.
And Noe, Mike Thorne of Kalihi was quick to call us in and share his knowledge with us. So he's the winner. That's the answer to today's quiz. And if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, whose students contribute 60,000 hours of community service annually. Learn more at sacredhearts.org. We'll be right back.
this. Aloha Got Soul is a multifaceted portal into Hawaii culture. A blog, SoundCloud mixes, DJ events, a record label, and a party pop-up that was recently received warmly in Japan. This is Aloha Got Soul. And Roger Bong is the purveyor of these entertainments. He's mining a particular segment of local culture to do it. Aloha, Roger.
Aloha, thanks. Purveyor, I like that.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to stick with that one.
Okay. Founder, owner, et cetera, of Aloha Got Soul. And so tell us, Roger, what originally got you started on local music of the 70s and 80s?
Yeah. Speaking of Japan, it was actually a Japanese DJ named DJ Muro, who's famous throughout the world for hip-hop and DJ mixes that he does. And he did one in particular in 2009 called Hawaiian Breaks, where he featured all kinds, like it was an hour's worth of local funk and soul music that started off with Mike Lundy, went into Aura, Lemuria, Mackie Fury's on there, Mel Kabang, like all kinds of people. Yeah, but it when I heard that, I was like, I had no idea who these artists were. And I was like, wow, it's from Hawaii. That's crazy. So I looked further into it. And that's how I got into the music.
Terrific. Okay, now you're talking about a period of music that a lot of people listening right now were not here for. So let's give them a taste, maybe.
Sure, yeah. Phase 7 was one of the bands that was during this era where Lemuria, Aura, Mike Lundy, et cetera, were playing. And they actually performed just last Saturday at the 70s nightclub reunion. But they were
See,
one
it's
of
getting
the,
to be a thing, guys.
Yeah, it's like it's the revival, right? The 70s revival. So shout out to Phase 7. But they represent this like funky R&B disco sound that came out of Hawaii. It was being performed by local bands in nightclubs in Waikiki. If you can imagine, Kalakaua Avenue used to be a place where you could drive down, park your car on the Ave, and then just hop nightclub to nightclub and just hear live music. So let's listen to Phase 7.
Right? It's a little Tower of Power. It's a little Chicago,
Latin.
And then this guy starts singing. He sounds local.
Yeah, he is. I think a song was written by a guitarist named Les Fernandez, who's in the band. Yeah, but they did Phase 7 did an album in 1980 called Playtime, and it's all originals.
Oh,
and so that's an original song written by one of the musicians. But yeah, isn't it good? Isn't it feel good? It sounds great. It doesn't. If you hear it, you might not think it's from Hawaii. I don't know if it's just me.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely kind of got the idioms of that period. I'll say that for it.
Absolutely.
And so that's a great taste of one part of Hawaii music a lot of people never noticed.
Yeah. It's just below the surface. If you look a little deeper, you'll find that there's all these musicians who exist in all kinds of so-called categories or genres, right? And so we not only have here in Hawaii this like disco, funk, soul spectrum, but there's all sorts of other music that's happening outside of what we all know being played on the radio today, which is, Hawaiian music, traditional Hawaiian music. Yeah, that's all great. And it's very well represented, but there's plenty more.
Like what?
There's a lot of electronic new age ambient musicians who are doing some really interesting things with technology, synthesizers, computers, but maybe they haven't had their chance to reach as many listeners
as they
can.
How would they have found them? So, would they say? What do they sound like? Do they sound local?
You know, I would say that's the thing I'm trying to put my finger on, right? Is everybody asks me, like, why, what is this sound? What is in this sound that makes it from Hawaii? And I'm still trying to figure that out, just like I'm still trying to figure out what Aloha Got Soul as a whole really encompasses.
Uh-huh.
But there's one artist in particular who I'm working with to do something early next year, and he goes by the name Moonbath. And he does a lot of curious, interesting, sometimes strange, like soothing soundscapes, very new agey. As you might imagine, like the 1980s, 1990s had new agey stuff, but it's from now. It's 2017, so maybe we could listen to that. It's much different than Phase 7.
Okay.
Beautiful. It builds. It's a long track. It's maybe 7 or 8 minutes.
Right. It's very, the genre of music.
Very different from the 3 or 4 minute format of a disco track or something. But it's made here from Hawaii and
happening now.
It's happening now, yeah. So
let's see. So this is the kind of music, maybe a musician like this working off somewhere in left field, it would seem, you could lift it up and bring them into a fold, like with other musicians from Hawaii.
Yeah, absolutely.
Huh.
And so over the years, I've been running Aloha Gatsoa as a blog since for the past 7 or 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And over that time, I've built an audience internationally who follow what I'm doing. And so,
really? Is that why you were so successful in Japan? That's what got me onto you, especially this time around, was your success with that pop-up in Japan.
You. Yeah. And
people loved it.
Thank you. We had a great turnout at an event we did in Japan. It was 2 events in 1 day. We went to this place called Beams in Harajuku, and they're a great big retailer, really well-known in Japan. But a friend of mine networked that and hooked that all up, and then we went to a nightclub later that evening and spun until we DJed until 5 a.m.
Oh.
And there was people at both events. It was packed. So we're definitely going back next year.
Oh, my gosh.
Japan. Yeah.
Okay, so you're dealing with music of the 70s, 80s, and maybe obscure pieces all the way through until the present.
Yeah. There's no limit, I would say.
Oh, man. Yeah. Are there other genres of music that we really should know about here?
You know, that's a great question, and I think we're going to shed some light on it. But I feel like maybe for the past 30-some years, there's been too much focus on it, like a few particular kinds of genres.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's time to open the doors back up and let people know throughout the world that we're doing all kinds of stuff, all kinds of music, but also people from Hawaii that anything's possible.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, you've got a harpist as our last chance to listen.
Yeah.
Momi?
Momi. Her name is Momi. She released 2 albums in the early 1980s with full bands. They're beautiful. She's playing the harp. She's singing. They're all original songs, her own poetry. Let's listen to that really quick.
I'm telling you, and this poor artist made it 15, 20 years ago and thought, aw.
Yeah.
And here you are,
yeah.
Roger.
Yeah. So Momi and I, we're gonna bring her back into the studio later this year and do some more recordings, some new recordings, maybe of her original work or old work that she recorded in the past. But those albums in particular were interesting because they had people like Jerry Bird on it. I think Henry Capono played with her, Kevin I, a lot of musicians who were very well established, and Momi did some beautiful music, but today it exists in this format that's very out of reach for everybody around the world. You know, the record's been out of print for a very long time.
Could we find more sound files, I guess, where on the Aloha Gatsoul website?
Yeah, alohagatsoul.com is where everything exists. Up until this point, I think I've done about 8 releases, working with different artists mostly from the funk and soul genre, but also electronic new age. So alohagatsoul.com.
Yeah. Funk and soul are so big here. They always have been.
Yeah.
I think of Eva Beach. We got it going with your website. Thank you so much, Roger.
Thank you.
It's been so much fun. All right. Roger Bong is the owner, founder of Aloha Gatsoul. Find them online. Or find links at the Conversation Facebook page. All right, Derek Malama from The Conversation joining us now for a look under the radar.
Yes.
What's going on, for example, on Capitol Hill? Let's get an inside look, Derek.
Okay, you can find out tomorrow night from Colleen Hanabusa. She's back in Honolulu for the summer break. The Congresswoman is holding a town hall at Kaimuki High School tomorrow night in the auditorium at 6:30, so bring your questions.
Sounds great. And there's a photography exhibit on Maui, stylish one, it sounds like.
Yeah, a student, Susan Middleton, once worked with Richard Avedon, and she has a new exhibit on Maui, exploring the world of underwater animals without backbones in this exhibit. It's called Spineless, Portraits of Marine Invertebrates, the Backbone of Life, and you'll see creatures you may never have seen before and you may never see again. And this exhibit is in the Schaefer International Gallery. It's Tuesday through Sunday until October 1st.
She's an amazing photographer. She did a series on the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. Beekeeping.
Okay, tomorrow night there's a meeting at 6 in the Kaumana Senior Center in Hilo. That's the Big Island Beekeepers Association, 6 o'clock tomorrow.
All right, Derek, thank you. Those beekeepers are a lot happier these days.
Yes, they are.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, we'll talk about continued development in Kapolei and look at what's going on in the second city.
And we'll sit down with the president of the Friends of Haiku Stairs and look at the shaky future of the Stairway to Heaven.
You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Noe Tanigawa.
I'm Chris Vandercook, and we'll meet you tomorrow for more of The Conversation.